So our first speaker is Harold Varmus. Harold studied at Amherst and Harvard, where he took a BA and then a postgraduate degree in English literature at Amherst. And then he went to Columbia, where he qualified in medicine, which is, I understand, what he initially had in mind when he signed up for Amherst, but then got seduced into English literature. He, in 1968, he joined the Public Health Service at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, the laboratory of Ira Paston, to work on regulation of bacterial gene expression. And this is the beginning of his long and distinguished career as a clinician scientist. In 1970, he began postdoctoral work in Michael Bishop's lab at the University of California, San Francisco. And there he and Bishop carried out the research that would win them in 1989 the Nobel Prize for Medicine or Physiology. And this was for the discovery of the cellular origin of retroviral oncogenes. He was on the faculty at UCSF from 1972 to, I think, 1993. And then in 1993, he took up a very prominent role as director of the National Institutes of Health at Bethesda, and there he did very well for the science budget. Since 2000, he's served as president of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. He, as many people know, has championed open access publishing and is one of the co-founders of the Public Library of Science. Last year, he was selected as one of the co-chairs of the Council of Advisors on Science and Technology to serve in the Obama administration. So this makes him everyone's favorite person as a scientist. And I think we've missed a trick today, because all we've done is asked him to give a talk. I gather he is an accomplished musician, and he and his son, Jacob, have performed a series of concerts entitled Genes and Jazz at the Guggenheim and at the Smithsonian. But unfortunately, we're not going to hear about that today. Instead, we're going to hear Darwinian ideas about cancer.
Well, Dean, thank you very much. This morning we bring science to Darwin, or Darwin to science. No God, not even God playing an air guitar, for those who were here yesterday. It's almost redundant, in a way, to talk about, or self-evident, to talk about Darwin in modern science. Variation and selection are inherent in the way in which we think as biomedical scientists. We also see evolution in other forms, new kinds of technologies, whether it's information technology or DNA sequencing, driving the way we study living organisms to try to make sense of disease. Even the way we publish papers evolves as a result of new innovations in communication with conversions from subscription-based to open access publications and public libraries that are digital and fully searchable. Darwinism, of course, is a concept that begins, as this very festival celebrates, well over 150 years ago, and yet has been enriched dramatically by a large constellation of other disciplines that have allowed us to understand some of the mechanistic basis of what Darwin observed and thought. And many of these approaches to science that led us to an understanding of genes as discrete elements, DNA as the chemical that encodes proteins and constitutes genes, the nature of mutations, the environmental forces that we now understand through the study of the environment, basis of taxonomy, and many other features of cells and organisms have played a role in allowing us to understand how profound the thinking of Darwin actually has been. Today I'd like to talk to you about how evolutionary thinking has affected the approach that medical scientists have taken to one of the major causes of human mortality, namely cancer. And I'd like to try to tell you in terms that are understandable even to the humanists, novelists, philosophers, theologians and others in the audience, not just the scientists, how evolution of somatic cells, not our germ cells, but cells that populate our organs and don't play a role in transmitting our genetic information to the next generation, play a critical role in the development of a lethal disease, namely cancer, in a complex organism. To tell you that, I need to spend just a couple of moments adding another important discipline to this list, namely microbiology. It would be my contention, and probably many others, that without the study of small organisms, much of what we know about modern biology affecting complex organisms would not have occurred. And that's true in part because microorganisms divide rapidly. They undergo many generations, even in a single hour or day, and they come in many different forms. They can be grown on dishes in culture in many cases, or they can be used to infect cells in culture in the case of viruses. And as a result, because work goes on in a speedy fashion, because you can isolate clones of either bacterial cells or fungal cells or clones of viruses that have infected single cells, because the phenotypes, the behaviors of these organisms and cells can be, and viruses can be studied very intensively and very precisely and quantitatively, because selection methods can be applied very quickly, mutants isolated, and pathogens, agents that cause human disease, studied at a very fundamental level, it's possible to make tremendous progress very quickly about the nature of genes and the way in which genes affect organisms, issues that are fundamental to what we think of as Darwinian behaviors. Let me illustrate that in just a couple of ways that are probably familiar to many of you. HIV, the cause of AIDS, is a virus that carries just a few genes in a genome composed of RNA. And because of an intense study of this small organism, it was possible to identify a few genes that encode enzymes that are required for the virus to replicate. These enzymes have become targets for effective therapies. One reason therapy often fails is because the virus is highly mutagenic. Every time it copies its roughly 10,000 nucleotide RNA strands, mistakes occur at roughly 1 in 10,000 to 100,000. Every progeny virus particle is basically a mutant, and those mutations often affect the genes that are targeted by the drugs. The result is that in the course of therapy, it's possible, especially in the absence of multi-drug therapy, that drug-resistant mutants will arise, and in a hostile environment, the presence of drug, only the drug-resistant variants will thrive and eventually outnumber the original wild-type infecting virus that was originally responsive to disease. And this fundamental concept, as you'll see, also applies to the study of cancer and to new ways to treat cancers once we understand the genetic underpinnings. Today, all of us in the audience are worried about the influenza virus, a virus which, like HIV, has an RNA genome, a very high mutagenic rate, and we're all living in expectation of what the next wave of the new H1N1 influenza virus will mean for all of us in the northern hemisphere when the fall arrives. This is a useful virus to study, not simply because it's a major cause of disease, but it also proves to be a way to explicate some of the principles of evolution, even to some of the most recalcitrant minds. And in our own country, where science suffered quite a severe set of obstacles in the previous administration, we did have a president who did understand that evolution does apply to the influenza virus, because in one of his talks during 2005, when the avian influenza virus was a potential threat to us, he said, "Changes in the influenza virus result in a new strain with the potential to sweep the globe." So even though this is a gentleman who endorsed the teaching of intelligent design in the science classroom, he did get the basic principles. This is a useful instrument in teaching about Darwinian principles. So let's get back to cancer, which is the main topic for the moment. And let me remind you about a few features of cancer cells. Cancer cells basically are cells that grow in high number in the wrong places and eventually lead to extinction of the function of complex organisms like ourselves. They have a variety of acquired traits that have been summarized recently by my colleagues Hanahan and Weinberg that include the limitless capacity to replicate, an ability to evade what we call programmed cell death, a mechanism by which cells are normally instructed to die and disappear. They have sufficient growth signals. They don't need growth stimuli from the outside. They're resistant to inhibitory signals. They have gained the capacity to invade tissues and metastasize to distant sites. They even have the ability to recruit blood vessels to provide food and oxygen, and they frequently manifest genomic instability, so mutations actually occur at a higher rate. And most of these traits, if not all, are due to multiple and largely somatic mutations and still poorly defined epigenetic events that affect gene expression by making changes in the way in which DNA is read out, even without actual changes in nucleotide sequence or chromosome structure. And the end result is too many cells and cells growing in the wrong places. Now, some of you may think there's something paradoxical here. Why is this Darwinian? Because what we're talking about are variations, mutations, and epigenetic events that promote the vitality of a single cell. That's good for the cell, but it's bad for the organism. And there are various ways to think about why we might preserve the capacity to have cancer afflict us. First, most of the mutations don't occur in the germline. They're not transmitted. Most of the changes occur in somatic cells. Secondly, most cancers, as I'm sure you're aware, arise later in life, after the peak of our reproductive phase. And thirdly, most of the genes that are essential for the causation of cancer, because they undergo the somatic mutations, are genes that are crucial for our normal development and growth. And of course, having mutational mechanisms that allow genetic variation is essential for speciation, adaptation, and so forth. Now, in the early days of thinking about cancer, 50s and 60s and so forth, one of the crucial questions was whether cancer arises from all cells in, say, colon or a liver or a lung or any other afflicted organ in which a cancer develops, or whether it arises from a single cell. So are cancers monoclonal or are they polyclonal? And while I don't have time to review all the evidence, it became quite apparent by the late 1960s that the correct model is that tumors are basically clones, having arisen from a single cell in an organ. Peter Knoll, who discovered an important chromosomal abnormality that I'll come back to in a moment, wrote in a famous article in Science in 1976 that despite the wide recognition that most neoplasms have a unicellular origin, namely are monoclonal, and a clonal growth pattern, relatively little emphasis has been placed on the developmental evolution of tumor cell populations and the apparent genetic instability underlying the sequential acquisition of biological characteristics that we associate with tumor progression, that is, progression from an early tumor that may not even be invasive to one that invades and metastasizes. And Knoll put together a chart shows how he imagined a tumor cell arising from the N, or normal cell, on the left and undergoing a series of genetic events, chromosomal translocations or other kinds of mutations, leading to leukemias, early tumors, finally malignant tumors, drug-resistant tumors. a chart not so unlike the famous chart that's in your program. You will note that the clarity of the reproduction of Darwin's drawing from 1837 is much greater than the one Peter Knowle published 32 years ago, and I ascribe this to the difficulty of getting access to a clear version of this figure, thanks to the publication practices of this journal, despite its sponsorship of this meeting. I'm cruel. Now, tumors may be the products of clonal evolution, but they are also heterogeneous, and I want to spend some time talking about this heterogeneity because it's a fundamental property of cancers and one that makes the problem interesting, it makes the problem difficult, accounts in many ways for our still incomplete understanding of cancer and our still far from complete ability to control it. The first point is sort of obvious, that cancers arise from different cell types in many different organs. They're essentially cancers as a class of diseases are essentially heterogeneous, and that's why claims that we have to cure cancer now are a little simplistic, because there are many kinds of cancers, certainly hundreds of different kinds to deal with. This is a kind of Linnaean exercise in which we look at cancers. For example, the lung has many cell types. Each of the major known cell types give rise to at least four major kinds of cancer that can be readily distinguished by a microscopist operating just the way some taxonomist hundreds of years ago might have operated. And we have to think about this as a problem right from the beginning. But even tumors of the same histological or Linnaean type have many different constellations of different kinds of mutations. And a very cursory view of the situation reveals just how complex the situation is. First, lots of these mutations are single nucleotide substitutions of the kind that is easiest to describe. Others are much more complex rearrangements of chromosomes that often defy complete understanding until the junctions of these rearrangements have undergone nucleotide sequencing. Now, around the world, here in Cambridge at the Sanger Center, throughout the U.S. and other countries, there are a variety of so-called genome projects underway to try to figure out exactly how a cancer cell differs from a normal cell in the same organism. And what that reveals is, first of all, that there are anywhere from a few to hundreds of somatic mutations in a cancer cell, phenomenon that may, in some sense, represent high mutation rates in those cells. Some of those mutations are doubtless functional, that is, give the attribute of high selectivity and natural selectivity to a cancer cell, but others are basically along for the ride. They're passenger mutations, which may not be so hard to figure out at first blush. Third, some, but not all of these, affect protein coding regions, and the others may either be passengers, or they may affect gene expression, or they may affect the mysterious microRNAs you've been hearing about occasionally that influence gene expression in other ways. Only a few entire cancer genomes have been fully sequenced, and that's something which will change very rapidly over the next couple of years. And in addition to observing these somatic mutations, we know that each of us have many differences from each other. Roughly one nucleotide in 1,000 is different from me and Bruce Alberts, my friend in the front row. And we still are wrestling with the question of which of those variations confer risks, inherent risks of lifetime susceptibility to cancer. Some of those variations are clearly variations that dispose us to cancers of certain types, but for most, the influence is uncertain. Let me give you one example of an effort to study one common kind of cancer, lung adenocarcinoma, major killer worldwide, roughly 1 million deaths a year from this disease. And when a few hundred tumors are analyzed, we see that some fairly well-known genes, like the P53 gene or the RAS gene, are mutated in roughly 30 or 35% of tumors. Many other genes, going to your right, are mutated much less frequently. The situation is even more complicated than it might appear from this slide, because when we look at individual tumors, for the distribution of mutations among those tumors, we see that there are many different kinds of combinations. Some mutations, even some that are quite frequent in the whole, never coexist in the same tumor, implying that those mutations confer the same benefit to a cell, that they don't coexist. And there are some tumors that don't have any mutations in the 200, the 600 and some genes that have been subjected to nucleotide sequencing in this exercise. And it's evidence like this that's leading us to a better understanding of cancer, but we're still in early days. A third point that is connected to some of the talks we've heard here earlier about the importance of development in trying to understand evolution is related to the fact that in our bodies, even though all of our cells have essentially the same collection of DNA, they differ dramatically with respect to their behavioral properties. And not only do they end up being lung cells or liver cells or brain cells, but in each organ, there are cells that represent different stages in the developmental process, and cancers could arise by changes in any of those cells in each of the developmental pathways that exist in each organ. And sometimes this is approachable by concerted study. For example, in the colon, an organ to which we have remarkable access thanks to colonoscopy, it's possible to see normal epithelium, early tumors that aren't malignant called adenomas, and frank cancers, and to sample those tumors and to begin to develop a lineage, a time course of tumor-inducing mutations, showing that one gene happens to be called APC, frequently the first mutation that converts normal epithelium to epithelium that's overgrowing a bit. Later on, mutations in the gene I mentioned a moment ago, RAS, and then other genes later on, finally resulting in full-fledged carcinomas. In other lineages we understand quite well, like the hematopoietic lineage, the blood-forming lineage, which is displayed in a very simple form here, we are able to study but still don't have a firm idea of which step in that developmental process is most susceptible to mutations of certain kinds that we know lead to leukemias. But in most other cancer settings, that is, most other organs that develop cancer, this aspect, the relationship between oncogenic mutations and development, remains quite mysterious. Another point has to do with the ability of cancer cells to manifest some of the properties for which they're selected. We know that even a cursory examination under the microscope of a cancer reveals morphological heterogeneity, and yet, in most cases, we don't know whether every cell has the potential to regenerate a new cancer. There are many who believe, either in some circumstances or in all, that cancers contain a subset of genes, sometimes referred to as cancer-reconstituting cells or cancer stem cells, that have the ability to regenerate a new cancer, as though a cancer is an organ that can undergo a developmental process emanating from a stem cell. Those are illustrated on the right in yellow, and this is an important concept because if one had therapies that did or did not attack the putative cancer-regenerating cell, drugs that did kill, that killed other cancer cells but not the stem cells would result in tumor recurrence, a fate commonly seen. If you had a drug that killed only the tumor stem cell, you could degenerate a tumor by killing specifically those cells. Fifthly, tumors are heterogeneous at yet another level. Tumors contain not just cells we know are cancer cells based on clonality and nature of mutations in those cells and the lineage in which they arise, but also other cells. Many of us are used to looking at cancer in a petri dish where all the cells are basically the same, but in a mouse model of disease or in human patients with cancer, we recognize immediately by looking at those cancers that in addition to the cancer cells shown as gray blobs, there are blood vessels, there are immune cells, there are cells often referred to as stroma that represent cells that come from surrounding areas and appear to communicate with cancer cells in a way that I don't have time to describe in detail here, but end up with the ability to recruit immune cells and recruit vascular cells to the tumor, essential features of the neoplastic process. The final point I'd like to make about tumor heterogeneity is that tumor cells often include or become drug-resistant cells, and they do that as a result of mutations that may either have been present at the time the tumor was discovered or subsequently. And the context in which that's most satisfactorily studied is a disease called chronic myeloid leukemia, a leukemia that has been made famous for a number of reasons. One, Peter Knoll, whose work I told you about earlier that led to this description of the clonal evolution of tumors, discovered the pathognomonic, the classical feature of the disease, the Philadelphia chromosome, illustrated by the truncated chromosomes on the right, a chromosome that results from the fusion of two human chromosomes to make an atypical chromosome that encodes a hybrid protein that has an unusual and persistent enzymatic activity that provokes the sustained growth of the leukemic cells. These tumors arise in about 6,000 patients in the U.S. every year. It's the most common form of adult leukemia. Previously, the life expectancy with this disease was 5 or 6 years. Famously, a drug was developed about 10 years ago, a drug called imatinib or Gleevec that inhibits the activity of that enzyme and puts patients in long-term remission. There are now patients who are alive and perfectly well as long as they continue to take this regrettably quite expensive drug every day. Yet some of these patients fail therapy, and the reason they fail therapy is because while the drug shown in orange on your left snugly fits into the enzymatically active site of this protein, mutations may occur that block the ability of the drug shown on the right in the horizontal gray form from fitting appropriately in the enzymatic active site. And in that circumstance, it's necessary to begin to look for drugs that work in some other way. Happily, at least two other drugs have been discovered that overcome drug resistance, so this disease has become even more controllable than it seemed a few years ago. But in many other common cancers, we don't yet have this backup of additional drugs to overcome drug resistance. Here's an example of a patient treated at my own institution who had advanced lung cancer, as can be seen by all the snowy forms in the lung field shown in this computerized tomogram. And on the left, you see extensive cancer. After 4 months of treatment on an enzymatic inhibitor that blocks a mutant enzyme, much of that cancer has been reduced. But as you see in the right-hand panel, tumor cells have recurred. And when you look at the recurrent tumor, you find it has a second mutation in the same gene. There has been variation, there's been random variation and generating a mutation that renders a mutant enzyme resistant to a drug, and then, of course, natural selection, because that drug can now grow in the hostile environment of the drug. Let me try to conclude with a recent story that pulls many of the notions I've tried to emphasize to you together. So this is a study carried out by Jim Downing and his colleagues at St. Jude Hospital in Memphis, recently published in Science. What Downing and his colleagues did was to look at a large series of children with a form of acute leukemia. Most of these patients can be successfully treated with modern therapy, but about 30% have multiple recurrences and frequently die. And when you examine the primary leukemia and then the subsequent versions of leukemia, the recurrent leukemias, with molecular tools of the type I've been illustrating, either analysis of chromosomes or nucleotide sequencing or other forms of genomic manipulation, one can show that the clone that arose at the time of diagnosis is frequently replaced when one looks at the relapse. And those very rarely are those recurrent clones genetically distinct from the initially diagnosed disease. More commonly, They represent clonal evolution from ancestral clones that include some mutations that are present in the earlier clones, but new clones as well. So what that says is that when the leukemia recurs, different subclones predominate, derived from ancestral cells. So in conclusion, I'd like to argue that Darwinism is very much alive in the clinic and in laboratories trying to study cancers, that there are at least three fundamental principles worthy of remembrance. One, that the cancers arise mainly by somatic evolution from a single cell. Secondly, the mutations are found in many other genes, and other changes of an epigenetic character are responsible for the attributes that allow cancers to overgrow normal cells. And the continued selection for drug resistance and other traits, like the ability to metastasize and invade, are fundamental to understanding of how cancer develops as a pathological process, and probably essential to our ability to control this dread disease. Thank you very much.